Welcome back to the Greg Kelly Podcast. What is a bad day for you? What is a bad day for me? You know, we've all gone through really, really big things. I'm not talking about that because those things happen to everybody, and sooner or later, we do get over it. Time, they say, heals all wounds, or maybe we don't get over it, but it becomes more manageable and it becomes a fixture. Right now, look, if you're unemployed or anything like that, I know that's heavy, heavy stuff. A lot of folks, though, whine and moan about the little things as if we have an expectation that everything is supposed to be perfect. Why are all these problems happening? Everything is supposed to be perfect. If you reverse that attitude, you know, problems are going to happen. Nothing's perfect. These things are supposed to happen. They're going to happen. Makes life a bit more manageable. I bring that up because I think of what Everett Alvarez went through. Everett Alvarez is our guest today. Right now, he's 83 years old. In 1964, he was a 26-year-old Navy jet pilot flying over Vietnam when he was shot down and captured by the North Vietnamese. 1964, August of 1964, that happened. He remained a prisoner of war until February of 1973. Is that incredible or what? Everett Alvarez. Now, at one point, that was a pretty famous name in America, and it's still a name in the history books, to be sure. But, you know, let's face it, it's not something that people talk about. When they think of POWs, they might remember John McCain, maybe Admiral Stockdale. That's pretty much it. The ordeal that they went through in our lifetimes, his lifetime, you know, it's not that long ago that these things happened. He was tortured, deprived of everything, married at the time, worried about his family, and just think of it, a prisoner of war. And think of what we have to go through day in and day out. Not too much in comparison. Now, I know we all can't, you know, and it's good, we shouldn't be. I'm not trying to guilt myself or anybody else into, well, you haven't served in a prison camp, but I am saying that with all the nonsense that's happening, I think each of us has a duty to stand up for ourselves and for our country. I think I may have mentioned before, I tell everybody, obey all the laws, of course, the rules, but there's lots of room there. And some people roll their eyes at this, but I have now become a kind of a crank letter writer. I send my letters to Nancy Pelosi and to Dr. Jill Biden and to Joe Biden and to the Academy Awards. What the hell else am I going to do with my time? I mean, there's lots to do with your time. But I'll tell you what I'm not doing. I'm not watching TV shows that go nowhere. I'm actually not reading books like I used to. What am I waiting for? I mean, I had a life to educate myself. Now this is it. This is a time to push back, to do whatever you can, whatever I can, to preserve this country. Melodramatic, maybe. Corny, maybe. But not really. Things are really weird right now. We'll talk more about that next time. But what's happening in all of the virtue signaling, this ridiculously stupid conversation we're having about race to avoid an important substantive conversation about race. So many people feeling shame about who they are. I can't say anything. What do I know? I'm just a white guy. This is really happening in America. And I am guessing you don't like it. And whether you're a liberal or you're a conservative, you know that the dialogue that's happening right now, the conversation is not an honest one. So, with that, I hope you'll enjoy the second part of my conversation with Everett Alvarez, who, by the way, after he became a naval officer and his career in the military, including that 9-year stint almost as a POW, had a very successful career in government and in business. All right. So, for the time being, though, I want to tell you about something very important. You have heard about the MyPillow guy, that awesome American Mike Lindell, who spent 2 years of his life working on making the perfect pillow. Well, Mike made such great pillows that he grew a thriving multi-million dollar business, delighting customers all over the country. Well, you know what Mike's latest project has been? He's created the perfect pair of slippers. Slippers. The MyPillow guy, Mike Lindell, just took another 2 years of his life to make the perfect pair of slippers. They are called My Slippers. And wait, hold on 1 second. Now I am wearing them. And they really are very soft, very, very comfortable. They're like a classic pair of moccasins made with super high quality suede leather lined with this cozy fur. It's not real fur, it's faux fur, and they do that on purpose. Number one, it's softer, and number two, it's humane. And they put this stuff over the same soft foam that Mike puts in his pillows. Mike also added a special impact gel to make it, kind of puts a little spring in the step. You can wear these things inside, outside, wherever you like. You'll feel like you're walking on a MyPillow all day long. You really will. It's very sweet. The only thing sweeter is that for a limited time only, Mike is offering a whopping 40% discount off of these My Slippers. Not 10% off, not 20% off, not 30% off, but a huge 40% off these awesome, very comfortable, very cozy slippers. You know why? Because Mike is committed to making Americans as comfortable as possible all day long and all night long. Please take my word for it. These are the most comfortable slippers in the world. You will wind up, most likely, if you're like me, getting them for the whole family. And I do, even my brother, my mom, and my dad, who really likes them. He kind of like, you know, falls in love with, you know, certain things and kind of proud of them. So do yourself a favor. Go to MyPillow.com. right now and click on the Radio Listener Square. You'll see it right there, the Radio Listener Square at MyPillow.com. Use the promo code GK, my initials, GK, and you'll get a huge discount on a ton of other MyPillow stuff, including the Giza Dream Bed Sheets. My wife told me about these. She actually put them on the bed, and they are fabulous. What else do we have? We have the MyPillow Towel Sets. The fluffiest towels in the world. So you can go to the website or call 800-975-3589, 800-975-3589. Use that promo code GK. One more time, 800-975-3589. Use the promo code GK. Go ahead and do it now, 800-975-3589. That phone call is important, and you use the promo code GK. I want you to feel as comfortable as I am, and I hope you enjoy them. I know you will. In the meantime, let's continue our conversation with Everett Alvarez, naval aviator and one of the longest-serving prisoners of war in American history. Hey, by the way, do you know there's video of you? I'm sure you obviously you'd know this, but I saw it this past week of, you know, your first moments, really, after you were shot down and some of those initial interrogations. They're available online. You've seen those, right?
Yes. And but the ones that they that you saw, those were staged. They were just staged for the film. There's some taken right after I was shot down, still photos. But then they had a couple of weeks later, they took me back and had my flight suit back on and my helmet and had me walking down a road and then into a building where there was a fellow sitting there and the cameras were all set up and there was fruit on the table. And so not much was said. That was all just for film.
You know, I remember, when I did see this video, it almost looked too good to be true in a weird way. Like when you're walking down basically a street, it looked like with that helmet on. Like,
yeah.
That's the kind of thing. And if you're an aviator, unless you're around a plane, you're not going to wear your helmet. It did occur to me for a moment that it just looked artificial, and now I know it was.
Well, yeah, and they they said, put your helmet on. I said, no, you don't do that. They said, put your helmet on and put that hat on, they called it. And so I put it on and I'm walking in, and here's the film guy right in front of me. So I dropped the visor. And so that was my act of defiance.
Well, you know, it was a pretty cool, I mean, I know this is the last thing on your mind, but it looked cool. I don't know what I mean by that, but I mean, it just looked cool. That was a cool helmet that you were wearing. It had, yeah. I think, the Thunderbolts on. I had seen a helmet like that when I was a kid, and it just, you looked
like, that was our squadron. We were the Roadrunners, and so they had a Roadrunner on the side, and they had the Thunderbolts, the international orange colored Thunderbolt.
What are these first couple of days like? Is it surreal? Is it? What was it like? Was it just?
You said it. It was eerily surreal. It was like I was going to wake up and get out of there. Any minute. One thing after another. When I was first shot down, I thought there was no way I was going to survive, and then I did. And then once they got me, I thought, oh man, they're going to kill me, and they didn't. They hid me from the population, the officials there. They hid me from the local populace for about a week. I was in a little farmhouse, heavily guarded by what the officer said were guerrillas. They were in civilian clothing, not uniform. And then about a week afterwards, in all this time, I'm name, rank, service number, date of birth, to the best of, not really talking until they came in, and the officer interrogator came in with a packet, like a little knapsack, and he opened it up. This was a week after I was shot down, and he had all of my hometown newspapers. He had the U.S. News and World Report. He had Time, Newsweek, and everything, with me on the cover, or the ship on the cover, or my the captain of the ship, and all. I mean, it was just everything, and especially my family, my wife at the time, and all about the family and all where my dad worked and everything, and so it was a little bit bewildering to me, because I never dreamed that I'd be splattered all over the country's the media. And number two, with regard to name, rank, service number, date of birth, what the heck, guys? So it was a little bit of a challenge to figure out what to do, how to do it, how to conduct myself. And I struggled with that for a while. And so in the end, I was pretty much relieved, because they came, and after I was there for a couple of weeks at the Hanoi Hilton, the officers came and they interrogated me. I had a long interrogation. It was 6 weeks of 6 days a week, morning, early morning to evening, and basically they just drilled me for everything they could. And that was that's what started a game, and in terms of what I wanted them to know and versus what I thought they might already know and what I did not want to talk about. And so we would go, you know, party back and forth. But in the end, you know, the officer I had, who was a pretty senior officer, basically said, look, you're a young guy. You're just a Lieutenant JG. You don't know anything really major, but we just want you to, they were basically feeding me a lot of the propaganda and stuff about, you know, their history and so forth. I recall that when I was first at the farmhouse, the first week, a high-ranking officer from the area came to see me, and the first thing, when they brought me into the room where he was, he looked at me, and then he stared out the window, and he started talking Vietnamese to the other officer, and the other officer was translating and said, "Oh, you're very young." He said, "Yeah, the other high-ranking officer was saying, you're very, very young." And he was just he just asked how I felt, and that was it. So from the beginning, they thought I was just a young guy, and so I played that up to the hilt. I really didn't know much.
So
yeah, it was a very interesting time, because here was me and the Vietnamese, and my country was halfway around the world, and my buddies and my ship was somewhere out there, and so it was a struggle in terms of you know, getting by day to day. And I do recall, like, I'm a very spiritual person in basically, I really depended a lot on that. And so that was a tough time for the first 6 months, and then the war started, when the bombing started up, and then I knew I was going to be there for a long, long time.
You say spiritual. Are you Christian? Are you can I ask what is your faith?
Yeah, I'm Christian.
And
I was raised Catholic. I was an altar boy.
So,
Christian church.
You were tortured, obviously. What kind of what did they do to you?
Well, they didn't physically harm me. I was sick a lot from the food and the diet, and so I lost a lot of weight at the beginning, but I managed to keep my spirits up, which was probably the most important thing. And then when the bombing started up in February of 65, I knew that I was not alone, because in a camp, which we later called the Hanoi Hilton, they used to bring food. They started bringing food from the outside and outside of the prison. And then I would peek out through a peek hole and watch the guy come into the courtyard with my tray of food. And then one day he brought in two trays, and one tray came to me, and the other tray went the other side. And I knew, I had read the propaganda that they had shot down Bob Shoemaker. And so I figured that's Bob Shoemaker's on the other side. And then little by little, the numbers of trays began to grow as they brought them in. And they would disperse them throughout the different areas of the camp, the prison. And I was watching all this through my little peephole on my door, that led into the cell, big, thick door that had a real tiny peephole. So I could see out, I had a limited view, but I could see basically all that, what was happening. And so I started to feel pretty good. And then they moved me from when they came one day and they wanted me to help them understand all these little gadgets that they had recovered from a plane they shot down. And there were kneeboard cards that we used to use on our, you know what I mean, Greg?
Yeah.
And with all these weapon settings and what have you, and they wanted to understand that, and I wouldn't budge talk, and so they moved me out into a tiny cell, and then a month later to a real tiny cell, 7x7, where I spent about March through September.
Hey, can I ask you this? There are questions about the kneeboard cards and the specification. Were they sophisticated questions? Were they onto something, or were they really just amateurish and had no clue?
You got it. They were amateurish. Yeah. And that's how I got away with the 6 weeks of interrogation. They were so amateurish, you know, you could lie. I tell people that one of the things that I did, because every time I would tell them something, it was designed more or less to raise your curiosity and get away from what I thought was important, what was stupid. And one time they asked me, what my duties were, and I told them I was so new that they put me in charge of the popcorn machine. Greg, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. And so they wanted to know what popcorn was. Popcorn, they didn't understand it. So I spent a couple of days talking nothing but popcorn. They said, they just don't understand this popcorn. And, it gave me a chance to talk about it. And I remember later on when Admiral Stockdale was shot down, a year after I was shot down. And he asked if Alvarez was there. And they said, oh, yeah. They told him I was there. And he talked to us, but he didn't say anything. And I thought that was mission accomplished in a way. But that was, I didn't find that out until a couple of years later. But as far as the torture goes, that didn't start up until 1966, about a year and a half after I was shot down. And that's when they started a campaign to get us to talk and to use us for propaganda. And that became pretty hard. So initially I was not physically tortured. It was just all illness and you know, the struggle all by myself. And then start of 1966, all the way through September of 1969, the conditions were very bad. They would have they'd come out and have torture sessions, and they just, you know, really run us through the ringer. And then after Ho Chi Minh died, and of course the Paris peace talks were on, things after 69, things gradually improved to the day we were released in 1973.
What kind of, and not to dwell on the gruesome, but when they did get to the torture phase, like what were they doing to you physically or mentally?
They wanted to break us in order to be compliant and to do what they wanted. They used to say, you know, we can do anything to you, and we will get you to do what we want. So that was their goal, to get us to do whenever they wanted us to do things, make tapes, propaganda, write favorable comments, write things and make tapes and statements against the war. They wanted to break our communication system. We developed a very elaborate, good, covert communication system that was really our lifeline. And it was a tapping through on the walls and other similar means. But I tell you, they would start out easy and then add the pressure. I remember in the initial days when they started this, they'd have you sitting on a stool, and you could sit in the stool and not let you sleep for days. They would come in, and finally they started after a week or so. If you lasted that long, they would cut off your food. Well, they cut off the food initially, but then they started rationing the water until you broke. And by this time, we had our military organization structure set up. So the senior officers were putting out the word Stockdale, Reisner, people like that, basically, you know, we just would resist to the point where we had to break, and then we gave them as little as possible. That was basically the strategy. I tease people because some of the Marines didn't understand that they just didn't give them anything, and they would get their bones broken and torture sessions and things like that. But I remember being thrown in a pit without a blanket or mosquito net and the mosquitoes at night were ferocious. And this was up at another camp up in the foothills to the west, and we were there with no electricity, what have you, and rodents all around you and what have you. I was thrown in there for about 3 days, and then all they wanted to do was to get me to write something how well I was being treated. And then at some points, when they were in a hurry for propaganda, they applied the ropes where you tied your hands, your wrists behind your back, and then they pulled you up by the rope, and that would dislocate shoulders. And they would wrap like fine piano wire around the arms and cut the circulation off, and that was painful. They applied these to me. They applied these big vise-like cuffs on that cut into the bone, and they would ratchet it tightly, and it was very painful. You couldn't last. Everybody's different, and everybody's pain level is different. But when I say everybody, it was the people around me, myself around me, that were being subjected to this. And, that lasted half a day. I remember another time, and they would do is they would push you, get you to the point where you gave in. You did a little bit of that, but it was really, you either made a tape or you wrote something that it was useless, really. And then they'd come back a month or so later, here they come again. And there was a time when they wanted me to go and have my picture taken somewhere. And I didn't want to. So for a couple of days, I was on my knees on gravel. Concrete floors, and they with your hands up, your arms up, and they would and if you dropped your arms, they would come in and whack you with their rifle butts and so forth. I had my jaw broken one time, and but it was uncommon. I had teeth knocked out.
Hey, can I ask you though, you get teeth knocked, gosh, now, you know, getting your jaw broken is a big deal. You got to wire it shut. You got to do all kinds of things. My cousin broke his jaw once, and he was out of commission for like 3 months. And what happened there? I mean, did they send you to the hospital, or is it something you just kind of know you're on your own, right?
Yeah, you're on your own. And to this day, it will lock out of place. I can't open it or I can't shut it. I have to move it around so I can. I have trouble. I cannot open my mouth real wide. I have to cut my food into small pieces. I'm a very slow eater. It's things like this. Oh, by the way, I went to. I finally they agreed to go with them, and they just took me downtown to some building, and I found myself on a rooftop, and there was either a East German or a Russian photographer, and he and that picture with a guard we used to call the Elf. That picture was circulated quite a bit, and I looked pretty scrawny then. I swore I was going to get hit with his. He was going to hit me with his camera, the photographer, and I. When I was in a camp, on that camp to the west of Hanoi, they took 50 of us. I'm sorry. They took about 26 of us from that camp. And we brought us into Hanoi on a truck. And we thought, hey, we're being liberated. We're going to go home. But what it turned out to be, they marched us down the street of Hanoi that night. That's called the parade, the Hanoi parade, in July 6, 1966. And things were pretty bad. Things were pretty bad around that time. The treatment. I remember I spent me and my two cellmates that I had at the time in '67. They had taken out one of the guys, Red Bird, to interrogation, and they didn't like his answer, so they pulled the three of us out and they put us into a small shed on the corner of this location that we called the Zoo. That was the name of that camp, which was a couple of miles. It was a few miles away from the Hanoi Hilton. And they handcuffed us behind our backs. They put our legs in leg irons. And so all we could do was sit up. And then if you laid back down, you were laying on your handcuffs, and they let us out 10 minutes a day, but I mean we were a filthy mess from our own excrement, and they let us out 10 minutes a day, twice a day, to feed us and clean up, and we were there for a week. That's just an example of the kind of treatment that punishment the camp commanders he had these rules that we had to answer every question, interrogation, and if we didn't do it properly we would be punished. Well, that's an example of the punishment.
Are you do you develop a tolerance, pain coping mechanisms, tricks or anything like you do, right?
Yeah, you do. Oh, absolutely. And you find these fellows would find little bits of straw. You had a it's ingenious what you come up with, that you make like a makeshift key that you could slip, you know, to these cuffs behind your back. You could manage to slip it in there and even you could loosen them up a bit, but then they would come in and they would stomp these things. They stomp on these things, the cuffs, and they just, tighten them. They were very, very crude, elementary type of handcuffs. So that's the kind of situation. But people would, Greg, you just have to do this. I mean, people would say, well, why would you do that? Just give them what they want. Well, you reach a point where you have to think about yourself and your dignity in a way, and also just to cave in without putting up any resistance. And it's in my way of thinking, it would damage my soul.
Can I ask you though, what were they looking for you to cave in to do? To like what did they want from you?
propaganda.
Participate in videos, sign statements, make statements.
Right. And then, of course, when they had one of the fellows escape, they pulled everybody in because they knew we were communicating, and they wanted to punish as many people as they could, and they actually killed a couple of people.
They killed a couple of American POWs?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, there were more than that couple over the years. A lot of people would make it to the camp, but then they never got into the system. They would initial interrogations that were pretty hard, harsh. Then there was a period for a year, 1967, 1968, where Cubans came in and took over portions of this camp we call the zoo. And I was screened initially to get into their Cuban program, we called it. But then they decided not to. So of all the people they screened, I was the only one not brought in. And they were pretty harsh. They were tough. They ran a portion of the camp their way. And I guess they were just, it was an experiment of having foreigners run the camps and treating and torturing prisoners.
I'm sorry, foreigners from where?
These were Cubans.
Cubans. So can I just, a couple of quick things here. So it's interesting, you're going, sometimes when you're accused of something, even if you didn't do it, I've heard of this happening psychologically, it actually happened to me, you can develop a guilty conscience. Even though you didn't do anything, you might feel guilty. And so let me ask you that. Did they ever make you feel guilty of doing something even when you hadn't done something? Or did they ever succeed in making, maybe not you, because you only flew, I believe it was your first mission where you were shot down, correct?
My first.
So perhaps for others who had been many, many missions, that they might have instilled a feeling of guilt for the bombs they dropped, for people they may have killed, that kind of thing.
That could have happened, Greg, but I do not, I don't know of anybody personally who actually felt guilty. There may have, I know that they've had their bombs sometimes would go into a target, but there would be, civilian structures nearby, and they could miscalculate the wind or something like that and cause collateral damage. I don't know anybody who felt guilty of that, but I'm sure it probably happened. They accused me of when they were passing a book one time, and they accused me of putting a mustache on Ho Chi Minh. He had a beard, but this would be a black mustache. And I was accused of that. So I was put again into isolation, and I was punished. But then I found out later that they accused several of the guys of doing that. Everybody was punished. So, and even talking loud, if you had a cellmate talking loud and you were heard outside the cell by the guards, you were breaking the camp regulations, talking loud. And so then you'd be pulled out and punished. I mean, they're always looking for an excuse to do something.
So can I ask you a couple of things then? Let's, number one, the camp gets a lot more crowded. People start showing up. Guys get shot down. And that actually makes life for you better, more interesting, easier. I mean, it's probably good to see, it's good to have colleagues, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I went 13 months, and then I was put in the camp where the first of the other Americans, we were put into this other camp. And that was my first real contact, face to face with some of the other POWs. And that was just a huge day for me. Here I was now, no longer alone, but living with others. And even though I was out in a cell by myself, I could talk to the other guys and occasionally see them. And then a few months later, I got my first cellmate. So it makes a huge difference. But, you know, living in close conditions like that, these were 7-foot by 7-foot cells. And, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for months, you can get pretty tired of the other guy. Hmm. So you had to learn tolerance. I mean, and you had to really learn tolerance. You can get on each other's nerves real, real bad. But you know, gradually we didn't ever get to the point where we never, if the other person was sick, you took care of them. And if you were sick, they took care of you. I mean, you depended on each other. So there was we developed pretty good, strong camaraderie with the people that were around us.
This whole thing about communicating via Morse code, which I know was done, you've spoken about it, everybody knows, was that a skill you learned before you got shot down?
No.
You learned it over there.
I learned it over there. It was brought in by one of the early shoot downs, Air Force pilot, Smitty Harris, who had learned that at the Air Force Survival School.
Did also the Stockdale, did you know him?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
What was he all about?
I can describe Jim Stockdale. Of course, I knew him before I was shot down. He brought his squadron VF-51 aboard the Constellation, and they shared our ready room. So I got to know him then. That was before I was shot down. I judge him to be the stoic. To me, he was the stoic. He was a senior officer. We had senior officers. But Jim Stockdale was the fellow who had studied at Stanford Graduate School, the Russian, the gulags, Solzhenitsyn, I think. And so he understood that philosophy, and he applied it to our situation. Very effective leader. He's someone that would not order you to do something unless he led the way. He did it himself, and so he was good. Robbie Reisner, I look at him. He was a spiritual leader. He was in a position when guys were first shot down. He got a hold of them, let them pray. The importance of praying, and taught him that, you know, when he could, taught people the tap code and what have you. So these guys, we had a lot of senior officers, but these guys stood out.
Can I ask you this? The guys, one thing about Stockdale, which I really didn't like, when he ran for vice president, I guess it was in 92, you know, he was mocked. Yep. They made fun of him. And he was probably a different type of personality in some part due to what he went through. I don't know, but
I
resented that. I assure you felt the same way.
Yeah. Well, I agree. I agree with that. And I also felt that, he was a great naval leader. He had no business into politics. Hmm. That's a different game. And he was a very, courageous individual, but, I fault the people that pushed him into politics. That was not his forte, and he was completely lost in it.
There were some people, by the way, who did sign those propaganda statements and made videos.
We all did.
Well, you all. What do you mean by that? You all did?
We all did that. That broke. Now, the ones that, you know, these were the guys that were shot down between myself and the beginning of the Paris peace talks, 1968. So there was a cessation of bombing up north, and everybody in there was forced to do things. The ones that didn't do things didn't come home.
Oh, I understand. All right. So you do things, you bend so you don't break.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, but there were some, and I think I've heard you speak about this, that, you know, accepted early release. That was the big thing that you was offered, and taking early release was considered, well, I mean, I guess they were some who wanted them prosecuted. How did you feel about those? How many accepted early release, and what were your thoughts on them?
I don't recall the exact number. There were there were about 9, 10 of them. A couple of those I thought had a good, one fella was ordered to go, Doug Hegdahl. But the others were just looking out for themselves. And these were guys that really, they had nothing, had been, they had not been tortured to do anything. But they were given, they took advantage of these early release periods, even though they were, the orders were nobody except early release. And so we, you know, we all stuck to that.
Now, what's the problem? And I know it is a problem, and I knew that when I was on active duty, and I went to SEER school, and we talked about it, but right now, at this moment, if you're signing this, just tell everybody, what is the problem with accepting early release?
Because you're breaking the bond with your fellow POWs. We all were going to come home together, and that was our and in doing so, you know, we had our honor. It was a bond, and we come home. We all come home together. These individuals broke that, and they weren't forced to do things and make statements. They did it.
Can I ask you this? Like, you all arrive separately. You know, in a typical prison environment, a traditional prison environment, people are kind of coming and going.
Sure.
And I'm not advocating for early release. Trust me on that. Now I'm just trying to get, like, was that almost sounds like an informal credo that, you know, we're all going to stick together here. Like, was it an informal credo, or was it actually, this is a mandated thing? And why is it, like, why would it be mandated?
It was an informal credo, but it was amongst the group. But it was something that would that strengthened our bond and strengthened our resistance. The fellows that broke this bond looked out. They put themselves beyond their fellow POWs, and that was basically they were the weak links and the chain that we had, the resolve that we had as a group was only as strong as its weakest link. And so these fellows really, to this day, they basically chose to ostracize themselves from the group. They never participated. They fell off the radar screen. They had guilt, and I'm convinced of that. They felt guilt because they broke the bond. And our struggle was to stand up to our captors as a unified group. That's what gave us the strength. And in the end, we won. They couldn't break us. They could not break our determination to just as a military organization. So we actually came out the victors in that battle. Yeah, not just, and that was as POWs.
So we will be back with that interview in just a moment. But first, I want to take a second to tell you about something that really, really annoys me. That's being ripped off. Now that the world is opening up again, I thought I would get my passport renewed. But please do not do what I did. I Googled passport renewal services, and a bunch of companies came up, and I'm seeing prices like $150, $200, even $280. That was the highest one, not including passport photos or the government fee. Now, what you're really paying for is the thousands of dollars these companies are paying to appear first on the Google search. So what you have to do is go directly to the App Store and download the It's Easy app. With It's Easy, you get exceptional five-star passport renewal service. That's under $35. $35! That is more like it. Passport renewal the smart way. So when I downloaded the It's Easy app, I found out that it was totally easy. You just fill out the application, and take your complimentary passport photo with your own phone. Yes, you fill out the application and take your complimentary passport photo with your own phone. You don't have to go to the drugstore or the passport photo place. You take the photo with your own phone, and then you print out the application that It's Easy immediately emails you with a trackable shipping label that's also included. Then all you have to do is print it out and send it in with your most recent passport, and that's it. Voila. It is so easy. It is so affordable. Under $35. Not the hundreds of dollars other companies are trying to milk from you so they can cover their huge Google advertising fees. If you visit the It's Easy website at itseasy.com, you'll see that It's Easy has been in business for 40 years, so you're getting 40 years of value. It is a five-star company that you can 100% trust with your documents. So, if you have to get a passport, I'm telling you, there is no other way. It's easy. Don't be fooled. Don't line the pockets of Google. They're rich enough already. When you need your passport renewed, think It's Easy. Just spell it out. I-T-S-E-A-S-Y. It's easy. Download the app from the Apple or Android store today. Do yourself a favor. Do your wallet a favor. And now back to the conversation. These guys who came back early, I think one of them is Chenoweth, right?
I don't recall all the names right now.
You mentioned one that was going to be appointed to some sort of position by Governor...
those guys, yeah, those were the two turncoats. These were two senior officers, one Navy, one Marine, who they did not get early release, but they sure as heck did everything they could. They were turncoats. They collaborated with the Vietnamese against us, and so they got special treatment. One in particular was he's just a evil person. Egoist, self-centered, all about himself. And the other one.
Something tells me you don't like saying these guys' names, but if you don't have a problem with that, I'd love to know their names.
Okay, Edison Miller. And the other fellow was a fellow that I thought was sick, and it turns out he did suffer some kind of a stroke, but that was Gene Wilbur. They were Commander Wilbur and Lieutenant Colonel Edison Miller. Edison Miller was the one that when we were released, they released the first group in order. We were released in order to shoot them, and so the very first shoot downs were the first group, and they stuck Edison Miller and Wilbur with our group. So that was their, quote, early release, unquote. So what we did is when we got home later on, Edison Miller had been somehow was involved with, to go back. When he came back, they were brought up for court-martial, but Secretary of the Navy at the time decided that there was not going to be any court martials, and so they were given bad conduct discharges.
Wow.
Edison Miller hired Melvin Bell, an attorney, to go back to expunge that from his records. And in doing so, he got to know quite a few people that were anti-war, because he was very, very anti-war. And excuse me. So what happened there is that he got involved with Jane Fonda's group. And this was in California. And so through their influence, he received an appointment by Governor Jerry Brown at the time to fill a vacancy in the California legislature. And the rest of us didn't find out until after the fact this had happened. So he was, he filled that term, and then he was running for re-election when we heard about it. So everybody, they passed a big petition. They took out a big full-page advertisement in the Orange County paper down in California. And he, and it was, this is what this guy did in prison. And it was signed by hundreds of guys. I was going to sign it, but I was in the process of moving to Washington from California at the time. And I put the paper, the petition aside. I didn't sign it, as it turns out. And I wanted to, but somehow it fell through the crack for me. And so as a result of that full-page ad, he lost, and he then turned around and blamed and sued everybody that signed that for slander. And I, of course, these cases take a long time. All the POWs that signed that were represented by USAA. And his attorneys were paid for by the Jane Fonda group. They came to me a couple of years later, because that's how long these things took, as a witness. And I was not a defendant, because I had not signed it, but I was a witness. So I was deposed in my office here in Washington in 1985. And at that point, I spent 2 days full testimony. And who shows up for that but Edison Miller, sitting right there. And I, you know, I told the story of what they did. They used to turn us in to the Vietnamese when they saw us communicating. Edison Miller and Wilbur used to let us out of our cells. They had the keys. And in the morning, this was when things were improving. But then they would, you know, they locked us up. They were like trustees. And they would lock us up in our cells and then lecture us on how, on the war, things of that nature. So that, and I went through the whole thing. Some fine points I can't remember. I'd have to refresh my memory, but I have the whole deposition, a copy of it. And as a result of that deposition, they threw the case out. Mm. So.
Wow. I mean, just one more thing on this. Do you feel a certain, and I know you have understandably contempt for these guys, but I'm just wondering, like, you know, nobody wants to get shot down. Nobody expects to get shot down. You can only do so much screening and evaluation that, you know, for whatever reason, that they just weren't cut out for POW life, that it was the last thing they had ever kind of really considered. I guess, though, every aviator's got to consider it. But they were just in over their heads. And, you know, these were, in a way, they were heroes because they volunteered. You know, they were flying dangerous missions. They got shot up, shot down. And, you know, lo and behold, 2% of every group, 3% of every group, whatever it is, 10%, 1%, 0.5%, is just not going to be cut out for it. They just will not be equipped to handle those kinds of stressors, or is it more of they did something willingly that they didn't have to?
Well, they did something willingly they didn't have to. But as far as the percentage goes, you find that in any combat situation, you'll find that the 5%, what have you, even though they're volunteers or they're drafted or they're career people. Then when they get into battle, into combat, you'll have a percentage that don't perform
and right.
don't live it up. But then the rest of them do, and the objective is to win the battle, to fight the battle and to win the war. And it was no different here. Our objective was to win, meaning to survive, but to survive with our honor. That's the motto of our group. Was return with honor, because someday we knew we were going to come home someday, however long it took. But we wanted to come home being able to hold our head up high and not be ashamed of our actions, and that was the battle. And these individuals, and there were several. There were a number who just couldn't live up to that.
Can I ask you about the Navy enlisted man who was a POW who got early release, but it was appropriate? I met him once. I met him at Sears School. And, I have this theory, and maybe we can't even talk about it, but I have no information, nothing. But when I learned his story, he fell overboard and became a POW, and there he is all those years later working for the government. And by the way, I think this would be totally great. I have no problem with it whatsoever. But it crossed my mind that he might have been put there on purpose by the government, by the CIA, by the military, something, because, it turns out he has an incredible memory and he was a great intelligence asset. And something told me that that could not have happened by accident. And I would give tremendous credit. That's what you want a central intelligence agency to do, to be for. Again, I've never even read this. I remember hearing a story in Sears School and wondering about it, and now I'm asking you about it. Am I crazy? Is that at all possible?
I'm not going to say, Greg, I'm not going to say you're crazy, but I never even gave that a thought. We had these speakers in the camps, and back then, and we were living in this one camp, and we heard that a sailor had been blown overboard and was picked up at sea, and he was a POW. And so our comment was, he went up to watch the fireworks, the show, and the concussion of the big guns. I think it was the New Jersey, not sure. They blew him off the deck of the ship. And so we figured, God, how smart could this guy be? And then when one day I'm looking out it, we're looking out the peephole of the little cell that we were in that looked at towards the front gate at the time. Here comes this. There was a new kid in a little cell that used to be like a little gatehouse by the front gate, and new people would be put in there. Well, one day this one guy came out, and he's walking around, looking around, dazed, and it was Doug Hegdahl, because I said to my cellmate at the time, I bet that's the guy that got blown off the ship. Look at the way he's walking around. And he was, really playing it up if he was playing dumb. And so later on, when they would let him out of his cell to pull weed, he would covertly take clumps of sand and put them down the gas tank of a Jeep. He was basically sabotaging the Jeep. However, that Jeep was rusted out, had no motor, and wasn't going anywhere. It hadn't been going anywhere for years. It couldn't. So, but not to take things away, he was smart enough to memorize the names, and we kept track. We all kept track of all the names, and we knew all the names of every individual. And he had been drilled by another guy, Dick Stratton, who drilled this into him, the names, because they had already started the release program, and the objective was if he was released, he was going to be able to give names, and he did take home names of the people, some of the individuals that our military had, they were missing, but they didn't know they were POWs. So you got to give him credit for that. And I think he just matured a
yeah.
lot.
No, I understand. So, by the way, just going forward now, did you ever, I guess you answered this in the last conversation we had. I was going to ask, like, this experience you had, 8 years, it potentially defines the rest of your life. And my question was going to, did it ever become a burden? Did it ever become a, but you mentioned that years would go by, or you know, you wouldn't even think about it. People would ask you about it occasionally, but it seemed to kind of occupy a smaller and smaller space in your life. Then at times you would, you know, write a book, or you would participate in a project, and it would be kind of revisited all over again. But my question to you, was this a burden going forward in your life?
No, I would not say it was a burden. When I came back, I recognized that, you know, the celebrity status, I think I mentioned to you before, my name, people would say it's a household word, and how long that lasted, I don't know, but it was there. I mean, I couldn't go anywhere without people looking at me and say, are you the one, are you the Alvarez? And that went on for years. And, you know, I'd be riding on an airplane or going places, but it was not foremost in my mind. I was a busy guy catching up with graduate school, law school, my career in the Navy, political jobs, starting businesses, but it never went away. And the more I started talking about it after the book came out, today I get more requests for podcasts like yours, or interviews, people doing that have done research, and I get mail correspondence from people who read the book, especially young people, autograph collectors, things of that nature, that I have time to devote more and talk. I have more time to talk to them about the experience. So it was never an obstacle. What was interesting was the celebrity status when we came back. We were not prepared for this. We used to, in camp, I remember one day it was a couple of years before we were released, and one of my cellmates and good friend to this day, Jerry Coffey, was saying, you know, one of these days when we get out of here, we're going to be asked to speak to people, and so we better be prepared to you know how to talk to people. I mean, we've taken speech classes in school and what have you. So we formed a Toastmasters group in the cell, and we would have speeches assigned and things like that, particularly impromptu speeches, and they'd give us a subject and we'd have to talk about it. So, you know, the thought of meeting and talking on the press was there, but never, we were not prepared. I was not prepared for the celebrity status that, you know, thrown into the first things. I mean, you come home and you're following you every day, the reporters, the headlines, in the papers, your pictures in the paper all the time. I threw out the first baseball for opening day of the Oakland A's 1973 season, and they won the series that year. Things like that. I mean, it was just one thing after another, a barrage by requests to go to these places. And I didn't realize that at the time. I said, oh, that's something I'm supposed to do. But the Navy, thank God for the Navy, they started screening all these requests and calls. And people would call and say, but you're supposed to be down here, and so forth. And I can recall my flying across country, and people would come up and say, here's the keys to my house in Florida. Use it. Take it here. Take it. And I'd say, well, you know, thank you. No, you take it. And you things like that. It was just
very nice.
I was not prepared for all that.
You were prepared. So I've heard you say this before, and it really kind of made sense that somehow release was anticlimactic.
Yeah.
How could something be anticlimactic that I'm sure you were looking forward to thinking about for a long time?
Well, you know, we've had so many emotional ups and downs, the cessation and bombing, and especially when the Paris peace talks started. Oh, man, we're going to be out of there in no time. And that was it took 4 more years. So there were so many anticlimactic ups and downs. And then you listen to the camp radio, the news, and you filter out all these things. But finally, the day came where emotionally, I would say mostly, I was drained. And having my hopes raised so many times that when the day came, I was cynical. I was glad that we were getting ready to leave, but I was still cynical. I was still thinking something was going to happen and we're going to go right back into the cells and what have you. So it wasn't until, like I think I told you before, that the plane actually took off from Vietnam and we were airborne and on our way out to sea that I looked at Bob next to me, Bob Shoemaker, and we said, well, this time it's for real. But when everybody erupted into cheers and what have you, we didn't. We just said, you know, it took comfort in the fact that we were on our way home, but it had taken so long. And more curiously, I was curious about what I was going to find when I landed in friendly territory, what it was going to be like. And I had no clue. And I had no clue that when we finally landed, the reception we received, you know, we were barraged with propaganda and how everybody was against the war so badly that I sometimes forget that there was anti-war and there was people that were not anti-war. But when I saw the huge crowd, and they were cheering for us and all these signs about, we love you, and, you know, welcome. I mean, that was just, I was just taken aback.
What about changes in your, with your family and your life? Did you have trepidation about what you were going to find, or did you have a pretty good idea through, I guess you were getting letters at least at some point, especially towards the end?
Yeah.
What were you
thinking? I had trepidation of what I was going to find. I knew that things had changed at home, but in terms of my marriage, it was. One of the things that I reflect is I should have taken more time to go back and go over events of what the family had gone through, especially with my first wife. And I understood that it was just too long of a wait, but I got off the plane. It was rush here, rush there. And like I said, every day was just, I got so many more things to do. And the thought of having time to reflect and talk about the people's, my family's experiences never came up. And I recall my mother at one point saying, when are you going to stay home so we could talk? Mm. I said, Mom, we'll find time. And I was like you said at one point, Greg, I was making up for lost time and I had a lot of things to do. And I fault myself for not taking time to go through of what my family, you know, did, what they went through.
You had no children at that point, or did you?
No, we did not. No. Thank God, we didn't.
Right. By the way, you had an interesting moment with Richard Nixon at the White House.
I did, yeah. I got home, and one of the first things we did, because we were so grateful that he got us out. I mean, when we had been there long enough, knew the Vietnamese thinking that there was no negotiating with these people. You're going to have to force them. And that's how it is with Asians in general. You can't, I mean, you have to, the only thing they respect is strength. And so we knew that it was going to take what it was going to take to get us out of there. And the question was how long we were going to be there and would we ever have the strength as a country to bomb the heck out of them. Well, Nixon did. And that happened finally. And so we were elated that he was doing that. So we were grateful. I was grateful to him. And I wrote him a letter when I got to the hospital in Oakland, California, and, you know, expressing my gratitude and thanking him for what he had done. And so to me, that was a courageous thing to do. And so he, when we went to the White House dinner, my wife was my date, and the girls, Julie and Tricia, she met them, and they told her that that her father has my letter and will pull it out every now and then. So,
I'm sorry, you wrote him from prison.
No, I wrote him the letter
after
from the hospital after I got back.
I understand. Okay.
And so we went to the White House dinner, and one of the things we did, one of the events that they had was to meet President Nixon at the State Department. So we, you know, we lined up and we met when it came my turn. He looked at me and he says, and he felt me, he felt my arms, and he says, "Oh, you look good, you look good." He said, "I want you to know," he said, "I tried. I tried hard." He said, "I tried very hard." And so to me, that was that he was really just doing everything he could, especially, you know, for me, I was there the longest to expedite getting us out of there.
And you had an affinity for him. Your family did as well. He was the kind of guy that I think you said at one point your father really kind of understood him.
Yeah, my dad did. Yeah, my dad understood him. My father, yeah, he understood. He was alone. The women in the house were, my mother and my sister were just doing anything to get me out of there. And it wasn't going to happen. Things took time and it had to go. Things had to fall in place, and the conduct of the whole thing was, it just took time.
You know, one thing, if you don't mind, a last thing, actually, you hear this from time to time that, well, I went through such and such, so this is nothing in comparison. Personally, I was in Iraq, or I, you know, something bad happened to me. So, you know, getting chewed out by the boss or whatever it is, you know, not a big deal. And I think that sounds great and it kind of, it's logical, but for me, it's not true. It's like whatever challenges I went through do not make the challenges of today, whether they're bigger or smaller, all that much more manageable, or they're not inconsequential because they're not life and death. They're still a big deal and they take up space. I would imagine, I've just heard other people say that, you know, well, after getting out of prison or after, you know, going through something like that, everything must be easy. What are your thoughts on that? Does that make sense? And what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I know what you're trying to say, and I agree with that totally. After going through an experience of that and like that, everything that I approached in my life, my career, I always looked upon it as a challenge, but it was never anything that was going to reach the scale of what I had gone through before. And so to me, everything was doable in one way or another. And even though you're having some pretty tough times, things are never as bleak as they were when you were getting, you know, the heck beat out of you in the cells there. So that's how I looked at life going on. The biggest joys, of course, was having get married and having my the children. That's something I often thought about when I was in the POW cells, and I figured I wondered if I ever would have the opportunity to have children. And when I did, that's the first time I really cried when my kids were born. I mean, just openly cried. In fact, just a side note here, my youngest son was born in July 6, 1976, 10 years after the Hanoi March. And this young person, he grew to be a Navy doctor, and followed the Navy, you know, a career. He's a Navy doctor. And you mentioned the Iraq War. So my son did two tours in Iraq with the Marines. And when he was in Iraq, the first tour, John McCain's son, I think it was Jack, was in the Marines in Iraq, same Andar province. And you know who else was there? Jim Webb's son was also a Marine in Iraq. They were all three in the same locale, basic area. And I thought, man, what a small world. Yeah.
You went back to Vietnam. You went back to Hanoi. You saw the Hanoi Hilton in the early 90s.
I did, yeah.
I know you had some concerns going over. John McCain said you should do this, but what was it like? Was it what happened over there? And did you ever meet one of your captors? Anybody who ever, you know, was mean to you, punished you, hurt you? Did you ever meet anybody on that trip?
I met one person, but he was the one, an officer that escorted me from the farmhouse I told you about to Hanoi. To the Hilton prison complex, and I went back the first time. That was before normalization of relations, and that was to do a movie, a documentary that this fellow wanted to do before the Vietnamese tore down the Hanoi Hilton. That was in world public opinion. That was a black eye in the Vietnamese's. For the Vietnamese, and so they were going to tear it down, and so I finally agreed to go with six of us to do a documentary. And I thought it was going to be a big propaganda thing. I thought, you know, we're going to pull in there, and here they're going to have all the flower women, and here they come, and they're going to be form, but now they're going to be peace-loving people and so forth. And so I was braced for this. And not only that, the people I told, they said, God, you're going to have such an emotional up and down. You better take some medical people with you, you know, doctors, nurses. And I said, I didn't think. That's why I called John. I said, hey, John, did you have a problem? Because he had just gone back. And he said, oh, no, don't listen to that. That's just a bunch of BS. And he told me what bars to go to and go, what hotel to stay in and so forth. Well, being the person, the position he had, he could stay at the best hotel. We were in it had air conditioning, but it was not anything like the best hotels in Hanoi. And anyway, we got there, the plane landed, and I looked out on the ramp, and it was just deserted, nothing. Nothing. Nobody. Yeah, so we had to go and get our own luggage, carry it, and they had a local crew to help us, had a truck, and we jumped on that, went into Hanoi. Nothing changed from when we left it. Everybody was in a peasant outfit, conical hats, riding bicycles. And the rats, dead rats, were on the gutter of the street. We walked in and to the hotel, and I had a roommate, Fred Cherry, who has since passed away. So we shared a room, and the first thing we did is we looked at the corner of the door jamb down below, and for tell, and sure enough, the telltale signs there. And so we went down and got some bananas and came back up and tossed them in the corner, but so that the rats would come in, they would go after the bananas and leave us alone.
So before I go, I do want to remind you, if you want crazy and crazy cheap passport renewal, think it's easy. It's like the best way to have your passport ready to go as soon as the world opens up again. I used It's Easy and already have my passport back. It is totally awesome. Download the It's Easy app from the App Store today or the Android App Store today. And remember, ITSEASY, ITSEASY, thank you. And how about that Everett Alvarez? What a great American, and his kids, and great American family. And I really mean this. Gosh, I've heard it a million times, and I never really... But sir, thank you for your service. Talk soon.